This is Conquering Columbus.
Hey, everybody, Mike here, and that makes this the Conquering Columbus podcast. On this episode of the show, Josh got the chance to sit down with Chris Lentz, owner and president of AutoSuite. This episode is full of great content, and early on in the show, Chris spoke on how a transition from creative writing to software helped him build an outlet for his creative energy.
What I learned over time with having that degree, I kind of felt insecure for a long time that I wasn't worthy because I didn't have a degree. I learned that I could really apply my creativity, and I found that I could create things using software, and that became a creative outlet for me. So that thing that I longed for in creative writing that maybe I wasn't real good at putting words together, I found that I could really do it with interfaces and more importantly, with talking to users and understanding what they wanted out of software and creating something that worked for them.
Later, Josh and Chris discussed the founding of AutoSuite and how it came to be.
We went out and put window stickers on cars, and I built a technology that did it. So I built the technology, and then I had some staff that went out and serviced the cars and took pictures of them and published it online so that all the cars would actually show up at cars.com and AutoTrader with photos. It was interesting. I learned a lot, and it really was the foundation of AutoSuite. That's really how AutoSuite came into being, as I was doing that work with my other partners, and I ended up selling my part of the business to them and ended up then building this physical inventory business using my own software.
We wrap up the show with Chris talking about the importance of purpose in a business and how it impacts not only the direction, but also the motivation of your team.
And we started thinking about that and saying, this just doesn't really work for us. What is our purpose? What's our cause? Why are we here? Why do we show up to work every day? And our purpose at AutoSuite is that we're here to do stuff we enjoy with technology. We're all nerds. We like it. And we want to do something with technology. We want to build a world that's better for us personally, professionally, and we want to enjoy the people that we're working with. That's really why we're working. It's to be a part of this community, to build something, to do things that we have that we think are fun, and to make our lives better year over year.
As always, thanks so much for tuning into the show. We hope you enjoy this interview. That's all for me for today. So sit back, relax, and enjoy episode number 356 of Conquering Columbus.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Conquering Columbus. Today on the show, we have Chris Lentz, the president and owner of AutoSuite. AutoSuite is a digital marketing and advertising firm that helps car dealerships nationwide drive quality website traffic, convert leads, and match back offline sales from their online advertising. Founded the company in 2004. Prior to that, he was a serial entrepreneur, has created three other companies, and also served in a variety of leadership and consulting roles into the tech space. Welcome. We're excited to have you on the show, Chris, talk about your journey, AutoSuite, and a lot more. Welcome to Conquering Columbus.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. Happy to be here.
You said you just got back from Vegas, huh?
Oh, you're going to bring that up.
Was this a work trip or a leisure trip?
A little bit of both. Every time I go to Vegas, in the automotive industry, you have to go out there a few times a year. And so I went out there to meet some vendors I work with, and then I stayed a couple extra days for pleasure.
Went there for, I guess I've been there twice prior to strictly for work, but I went there for the first time for pleasure probably like 3 weeks ago or so.
Oh, really? Close.
Went down there. Yeah, it was close and almost overlapped. We went down there for a concert, a Jack Johnson concert at, might have been the Wynn, I believe. And then we did one of the Cirque de Soleil. I'm going to bastardize that pronunciation.
Cirque du Soleil. Yeah.
Cirque du Soleil shows on.
People love that stuff.
So it was cool. Have you seen one?
I think I've seen almost all of them. I got bored with them about 15 years ago, though. So mostly because I don't like clowns.
Yeah. If you go out there a lot, I'm sure it would get old rather quickly.
Yeah, I go out about four times a year. There's usually a trade show there four times a year. So that's been a pretty consistent thing for 25 years for me. So
it's a good amount.
It really is. And my wife is probably going to be glad to hear this. It's getting old.
Well, it's surprising too, the geography. Like, I don't think about this about Vegas, and I know the whole town shouldn't even exist. And the only reason it does because the dam and everything, but it's kind of a beautiful area. Like you look out and you got even the airport, the mountain scenery and everything is really incredible.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And I will say in all the years I've gone there, I really haven't gone outside the city because mostly I'm there working and usually just staying a couple days. So you find other things to do while you're there. But I do have some friends who have done a lot of things from biking to going to concerts at Red Rock Canyon and things like that. And they all say it's enjoyable. Someday, maybe I'll start going out there for that.
So where did you grow up? Were you originally from Columbus?
Grew up in Ohio, born and bred, outside of Cleveland, a small town called Wycliffe. It's 20 miles east of Cleveland. And I grew up there, was there until I graduated high school, found some time in the Army, and then met somebody and moved down here and went to school at Ohio State and never left, just like a lot of people.
So what was that Army experience like? Were you one of the people who look back on it and kind of, I think some people don't speak about it openly, but some people look back and they kind of, they regret it, you know, because you're young and it's a pretty serious decision you might not realize at the time. And some people look back and they really treasure it.
I did enjoy it. It was a big growing up experience for me. I think that, you know, you grow up in a town and you're very isolated. You kind of, you know, have your friends and your cliques and all the stuff you do. And you get a rude awakening when you go to basic training. And it kind of wakes you up. And it felt to me like a growing up to be a man kind of moment. I enjoyed it. I was a reservist for 9 years. And I never served overseas or anything like that. But I felt duty to my country. And I absolutely enjoyed and valued the time. Thought for a while to be a 20-year or something like that. And at some point, I decided I had to focus on family and work. And that was more important to me than the Army. So I let that go to the wayside. But I thought it was a good experience overall, and I'd recommend it to a lot of people.
It's interesting. You do see a lot of entrepreneurs who have had military backgrounds because of the discipline and the ability to kind of take initiative and drive your own destiny. But also, you don't see a lot that would be in there for 20 years or so because of just the constant desire to do something more and bigger and change. And so when you look back on that point in your life, did you still have the same ambitions to be an entrepreneur and grow your career in that way, or were you just figuring it out?
You know, I think that I had an idea or a glimpse of an idea in my head all along that I was going to be some sort of business owner. Even when I was in high school, I was very active, did a lot of leadership roles in high school, did a lot of varied activities in colleges and fraternity stuff, do leadership stuff there. And I just had always thought that being in business for myself was kind of a destiny. And then you get into the work world and you see how it all works. I worked for a big company. I worked for Bell Labs for a while as a consultant, actually, but so, I guess technically make that clear. But I was there for, I think, 3 or 4 years. And then I also went to work for another small company here in Columbus. And I thought I'd try both ends of the spectrum. And being there and seeing how the leadership did things and how people that were down low, essentially, and how they reacted to that and how it affected their lives, it really made me think, I can do some things better. And it, so that entrepreneurial kind of idea about getting in there and making things happen and do better struck me really hard. And I found opportunities to make it happen.
What was your degree in at Ohio State?
Creative writing.
Wow. What were you going to do with that?
I think when I went into it, I had an idea that I wanted to be a teacher. I had some teachers in high school that were very active in theater and very active in writing. And I had some idea that I was going to create big ideas and maybe teach kids the same thing. I took education at Ohio State for a while and I did a couple teaching experiences. And I said, this is not for me. I was dealing with middle school kids and I said, I can't do this for the rest of my life. So I opted to go into business. And you know, the thing, and I tried writing too. I was also a creative writer. My emphasis was in creative writing. I tried to write a book. I did actually. And it was awful. It was the worst book you would ever read. My poetry was probably awful too. But some of that might've been good. And I got into computer programming and I wish I had actually studied that in college, to tell you the truth, because I was really good at it. And I think having a foundational thing would have been much more helpful when I went to a place like Bell Labs. And I think what I learned over time with having that degree, I kind of felt insecure for a long time that I wasn't worthy because I didn't have a degree. I learned that I could really apply my creativity, and I found that I could create things using software, and that became a creative outlet for me. So that thing that I longed for in creative writing that maybe I wasn't real good at putting words together, I found that I could really do it with interfaces and more importantly with talking to users and understanding what they wanted out of software and creating something that worked for them. And I think early on in my career, I remember talking to some business leaders, and I worked at Bank One at the time. I think it's Chase now. I talked to some business leaders there, and they said a huge percentage of their VPs were actually creative writing majors or English majors. And part of the reason is that learning to communicate is really an important skill as a leader. You really have to, you know, I guess, listen to people, not just your customers, but the employees, to kind of just pull everything together and kind of coordinate it and make things work for people and really learn to solve their problems with the technology that you're building. And I think that being a creative person helped me do that.
How many jobs did you jump between after Ohio State prior to creating your first company?
Let's see. I mean, real professional jobs, I think it was really just two, maybe three. I worked for somebody I knew for a while as an office manager where I had to do all kinds of different stuff. And he was an entrepreneur. He had like five employees. And I really learned a lot about running businesses with him, small businesses and what it took. And really, I learned with him, roll up your sleeves and do things. I was the office manager and he was an engineer. I had to build circuits. And so I did a lot of interesting stuff there. I built some databases, and that was fun. When I worked at Bell Labs, I started off as a technical writer, which makes sense as a creative writing and an English major. And in the 3 or 4 years that I was there, whatever that time was, I don't remember, it was a while ago, I changed into user interface design and ended up creating an entire interface and a new application for the customers. Because it was interesting. It kind of goes back to what I just said. I went there and I went on this exploratory mission with all their users to find out how I could improve their documentation on this product that Bell Labs had created. And I came back and I said, you know, I talked to all your users and what they say, the documentation's fine. It's the software that's bad. And so I said, I've got some ideas. And so I spec'd it all out, put it together, and we sold it to the company. So right out of the gate with a big company, I was able to talk to customers, conceive of an idea, put together an interface, and effectively sell it and make a couple million dollars for Bell Labs in the process. And so it was a real eye-opening experience for me. I took that to a smaller company and learned what I could do there and tried to do some similar things. And we were building, at the time, we were building HTML course creation documents and building the software to produce that. And it was kind of fun. It got me into the World Wide Web, which was new in 1990. So I saw the technology and the promise of that. And I said, this is something I have to do. And so I started a business.
What year is this that you start the business?
The first business that I started was late 1994. So it was, I was actually luckily enough, Bell Labs, I was an early adopter of HTML and all the things World Wide Web that was necessary to create websites. And I saw the possibility for how to create dynamic documents and hyperlink documents and how that could be used for training and everything. So I was kind of lucky to be at the forefront of all that. And I had a business partner with my first company, and we were constantly looking for what products we could build. And we built a lot of really interesting stuff. It was fun. I built the first online searchable database of the Ohio laws for the Department of Administrative Services. And for many years, honestly, I don't know if it's still used, but for many years, it was the place where people and law students went to go and get their law information online. And we did that for a number of years. I built an online searchable database for the Ohio Historical Society and the Ohio Library Association and the U.S. Trotting Association, just some really fun, interesting first kind of projects as an entrepreneur. But they weren't products. And my partner and I really, really wanted to have something that we could build once and sell to 1,000 people. So we kept trying different things and experimenting. And it was fun. It was, you know, I was always building something new from a software perspective and getting out there, and we were trying to figure out how to sell it. Well, my partner was, he had an automotive background. I did not. I'd never done anything in automotive at all. And he had a bunch of car dealerships here in Ohio that he used to sell to. And they were asking him questions about how they could put their inventory online. So we figured out, you know, how to get inventory from their accounting systems. We figured out how to build websites for them. And we were kind of, I guess, pioneers a little bit in that. We were one of the first people to start it and doing the kind of data integration that we were really good at. That's kind of my specialty, is big databases and that sort of thing. It was fun. We really enjoyed it. But what we really latched on to early on, probably around 98 or 99, was a lot of car dealerships were struggling to capture all the leads, as they call it, from all the different websites that they were signing up for, things like Auto by Tell and Auto Trader and Cars.com, and their Ford sites were sending them all these leads. They were all coming into these different systems that these car dealerships had to log into, like 10 different systems, to get their leads. So we built one of the first first automotive-specific CRMs. And it was widely successful, actually piloted it. I built it first for Reichert Automotive here. They worked with me. We went out, worked with them, and I worked with the team out there to figure out some good things to do and what their processes were. And we kind of built a system around that and expanded it from there. And we worked with a lot of different people. We worked with Toyota, Mercedes-Benz, Mitsubishi, I think was another one that we worked with at the time. And anyway, we ended up doing a lot of stuff for them specifically and built a very powerful and probably one of the best CRMs at the time for the automotive vertical. Did that for, I think, 5 years. All that other stuff that we did for the state kind of just went to the back burner, and we really focused on that one thing that we could scale, which is, I found, really to be an important thing in business. Is you've got to find, if you're building a product, you've got to find something that really kind of can explode. And that did for us. We got to the point where we were supporting about 2,500 dealerships nationwide and made the decision to sell that because we wanted to do some other things. We had some other product ideas, and we both went our separate directions and did that. And it was fun.
Was that an on-site hosted model, or were you a SaaS company at that time?
We didn't call it SaaS company then. It was an online module, though. And there were some interesting competitors that were doing kind of an on-site model for the same thing. And I think the online ones went out.
So, and then what year does the sale happen for this?
For me, the first company I sold was 2003.
2003. Do you take time off at that point, or do you jump right into the next thing?
It's funny. I said I retired. At 38. And I did take about 2 years off. And I did a couple things. I actually had started another company prior to that. And I kind of monitored it and did some stuff as a board member. And then I started another company, but I wasn't really actively working in any of them. So I started two more companies at the time I was retired. And they were automotive specific. And they were through partners that I had had. We kind of got together and decided to do some things. The thing I did was physical inventory in the automotive space. Very exciting. We went out and put window stickers on cars, and I built a technology that did it. So I built the technology, and then I had some staff that went out and serviced the cars and took pictures of them and published it online so that all the cars would actually show up at cars.com and Auto Trader with photos. It was interesting. I learned a lot, and it really was the foundation of AutoSuite. That's really how AutoSuite came into being, as I was doing that work with my other partners, and I ended up selling my part of the business to them and ended up then building this physical inventory business using my own software, and did that for really about 10 years we did that. But what we learned in the 10 years there was that we didn't like the work of managing a huge staff nationwide that had to go out and do all this physical inventory work. The people management was a lot of work. And so
isn't that something that we just do in-house? It seems so easy. We just go out, count the cars once a day.
It's not. It's not easy. You have to have personnel that knows how to take a good photo, knows how to do it consistently, and then you have to use particular technology to make sure it's formatted correctly. And over the years, the whole process evolved, and there are a lot of opportunities, including our software, where they could go out and do it themselves, but most dealerships couldn't manage it. There's also a management process to make sure that people are doing it. And so we had a structured management process that we went and sold to the dealerships and said, this is what we're going to do for you. We've got quality control, and we can do all these things on top of it. So it was successful. And I eventually sold that piece because I really wanted to focus just on the marketing. So we exposed ourselves to a bunch of dealerships who were marketing their cars. And we found out through doing that, that they wanted to do other kinds of marketing things. And so we started building software to automate the marketing of their software. And we started with posting cars on Craigslist. And then from there, we became a Facebook Meta partner. They were Facebook back then. They're Meta now, but we were one of the first partners to actually pilot some of their innovative ways to publish inventory to their audience. They had a Facebook Marketplace product that we were one of the first people to do. We're also a Google partner. And so we found a lot of automated ways to publish inventory to Google and other channels. But the thing that really was foundational for us to be doing that inventory and to have an inventory management base that we could take things that we learned about that and what our customers were saying they wanted to do, much like I did in the CRM space. I listened to the customers who had websites and who were dealing with all these leads and figured out that they needed a CRM that put it all together. Well, we're doing the same thing in the automotive inventory marketing space today, as we are taking inventory that dealerships have and we're finding different places to produce the most effective inventory marketing for them. And we measure it, things that they can't really necessarily do unless they have a marketing department. We're measuring the effectiveness of this ad versus this ad. We're creating the right ones. We're automating different platforms for them and just make it streamlined and easy to get what's most important to their business, their product, in front of consumers as quickly as possible.
So are you still involved on the inventory control and management side as well?
No, I actually sold that business. I think it's been 2 years now. I sold it to another company. Actually, it was original company that I was a founder of. So it's called Auto Uplink USA, and I sold my portion of it to them, and they do it nationwide. And at a point, we made a decision that we weren't going to focus on that anymore. And so I started looking for opportunities with people that did focus on it so that they could grow their business and focus on that specific thing. And then we focus specifically on the marketing pieces.
Hey, everybody. Mike here. We're going to take a quick break to talk about one of our sponsors, One Columbus. And we are very excited to partner with One Columbus. They really, really share the same vision as us here at the Conquering Columbus podcast, which is really building up the Columbus region to be one of the most prosperous regions in the United States. And One Columbus serves as the business location resource for companies across Central Ohio and around the world as those companies grow, innovate, and compete within the global economy. And they help us lead a regional growth strategy that develops and attracts the world's most competitive companies, grows a highly adaptive workforce, and prepares our communities for the future, inspiring innovation across the board. Their mission really is just ensuring the Columbus region is a vibrant place to build businesses and careers. So again, we really appreciate all of their support. You want to learn more about them, go check out their website, columbusregion.com. That's columbusregion.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll be right back into the episode.
So now you're at a point where you're predominantly focused on the digital marketing strategy and optimization for dealerships across the U.S. for their inventory. How big are you guys today?
We support 850 dealerships nationwide. And I'd say we're doing pretty good. We're on a nice growth trajectory. It's nice to see that coming out of COVID, we were able to continue the growth trajectory that we had started before that. Just a little bit of pause there for where everybody kind of shut down for 6 months, it seemed like. And the automotive business has actually gone through a lot of upheaval in the past 3 years as a result of supply chain issues and all kinds of stuff. So a lot of things have changed where, you know, last year it wasn't a real good idea to market your new car inventory because you didn't have any, but we were strong in focusing on the used car inventory. So we were able to pivot towards that. But yeah, that's our primary focus. And we've had some exciting things happen recently. We've been looking for some opportunities to grow, not just through organic growth, but we've been looking for opportunities to acquire other companies. And so I found a marketing company that was focused primarily in automotive, but they also have a little bit of non-automotive vertical work that they're doing. And we finished up an acquisition back in January. So my first quarter has been just crazy trying to figure out how to bring two companies together and make sure everything works. But we're both focused on automotive primarily. Real good synergy. We have a lot of technology. They're an agency, essentially, and their company's name is Bitmoto. They are actually out of Pennsylvania, and they focus on marketing and real traditional kind of agency work. And we focus on the technology that helps agencies deliver the work. So we're learning some things, and I'm real excited about, you know, getting our technology into their hands so that they can take advantage of it. And I'm also excited about learning more about the agency world and how we might service them better. I think it's going to help us grow a lot. I think we're going to learn more about their needs and probably build our tech a little more focused on their needs, which is important.
Kind of like a vertical integration play to some extent. I mean, covering the creative, the copy, maybe some more of the print collateral type things, and then meshing that with your digital world.
Yeah. We don't focus at AutoSuite. We've not focused on a lot of content creation. We've focused more on digital tech and integration. One of our strong suits, and I've been doing this since back to my first company, AVV, when that dealership said to me, how can I market my inventory? The first thing that I learned how to do was to get into their accounting systems and extract their inventory out, repurpose it, and put it on a website. Well, since that time back in 1994 when I first did that for Gerald Deeson in Chicago. I built on that technology, and now we're a full-service data integration provider. We're partners with some big companies like CDK and Reynolds & Reynolds and DealerSocket and some other big companies that are out there that have that inventory in what's called the dealer management system. And not only do they have that, but they also have sales and service data, like every transaction that takes place at the dealership, whether it's service or sales, they have this accounting system that basically keeps track of it. Well, we're able to extract that information out and use it for marketing purposes and use it for measuring ROI. So we've got this real tight integration, and that is a powerful piece of technology, this DMS integration that we have that agencies typically don't have. It's not something that data part is really not important. And what's good about it for us that I get excited about when I talk about it is I love being able to share with a dealership that this marketing effort that we did for you, we put these ads on Facebook for you, it drove traffic to your website, and you can measure that in your Google Analytics and stuff like that. But what I can do is I can look at your sales data, and I can tell you if somebody browsed and looked at your vehicle on Facebook, I can tell you if they actually purchased from you. So you can measure the ROI. I spent $2,000 on a Facebook marketing campaign, and I sold 17 cars from people who looked at it or clicked on it. And we can do the same thing with email marketing, where if I send you an email about a car, you interact with that email as a consumer, and then you come in and purchase. I know I sent you that information. I know you interacted with it. And now I can tell the dealership, you spent this amount of money on an email campaign and it generated this amount of ROI. So a dealership can use the data, the big data that they have, and actually measure ROI and make marketing decisions based on it. And we use it to also determine what kind of campaigns we suggest to dealerships. Like, we've run this campaign, you know, for 25 or 50 different dealerships, and it has this kind of effectiveness, and we've run this campaign for 100, so we can give the dealership a more informed decision. So it's exciting.
And so you will just pixel those consumers, and then you'll match that with the purchase data that comes out of the other side of the dealership?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, what we do on the Facebook side is Facebook has first-party data, and we have first-party data, and there's points of that that we can share together that help us both identify what's going on. It's really, there are some pixels that are tracked by each of us that helps us do that. On the email side, it's a little easier. It's almost like sending a direct mail campaign. I know I sent you a card. I know I sent you something physically, or I sent you an email physically, because I know your email address and I know your physical address. And then you come in and purchase, and you have to fill out all that stuff. So the dealership has some first-party data, and we know that we sent it to you because we have a big first-party database of people we can send to. So we just kind of marry those two things together, and I can say, I sent you an email, and you purchased, and so I can give you that information. It's a lot of data integration stuff that sounds a little bit easy, but it's getting it all tied together and getting systems to work so that it happens automatically is very complicated. And that's where we come into play to help agencies and to help dealerships measure their marketing.
Do you guys worry at all about the state of car dealerships going forward? I mean, with Tesla going direct to the consumer and this rise for electric vehicles and everybody trying to kind of model what Tesla is doing, do you still continue to see dealerships open up and grow going forward?
Well, we see a lot of consolidation in the industry, and there's a lot of big players that are trying to buy up a lot of dealerships. And we're certainly a little bit concerned about the long-term play of the manufacturers taking over and dealers not being there. But I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm 55, I think. For 25 years, that's been a concern. It really has been. I mean, because the consolidation has been happening for a while, and there's been a lot of different companies that have come up. I think that there's more of it that's going to happen, and there's going to absolutely be more manufacturers. But we can work directly with manufacturers and do some of this stuff. But more importantly, we work with used cars, and used cars or dealerships are probably not going to go away for 50 years. I can't even imagine. Not in my lifetime. It's not something I have to worry about.
And then on the other side of that, have you ever considered the MSP route for these dealerships rather than just vertically integrating into the content, like expanding more of the service offerings they're using from a technology perspective? I'm surprised you guys haven't branched into that.
We've talked about it. We've talked about a couple different things. And no, we haven't branched into that. We really have a hard time keeping up with all the technology that we need. Marketing is an ever-changing landscape. I mean, who would have thought that 7, 8 years ago that Facebook was going to be something that people had to market their inventory on in order to get access to consumers. So, and Pinterest is a new thing, and there's all kinds of YouTube advertising, and now we've got CCTV and just different ways to market to people. So there's just so many things that change in the marketing landscape every single day. And to your point, one of the reasons why we did do this acquisition was because we were excited about learning about other verticals. There's tech that we can apply to help agencies in other verticals. We don't even know about it yet. That's an exciting new venture for me over the next, you know, 3-4 years to start to learn about other verticals and how I might be able to take my technology brain and tie things together and make marketing more efficient for them.
What about challenges along the way? As you reflect back on the journey and everything that's happened since creating the company, were there points where you thought, was it going to make it? Or it was very difficult? Or is it always just kind of, I mean, because your story seems like it flows so naturally and one thing came to the next and you weren't really putting too much pressure on yourself to figure out where do I got to go? What do I have to do? And you didn't really just listen to people, but it can be often very hard to just listen. And I'm wondering if there was challenges in that journey as well.
There've obviously been a lot of challenges. You can't be in business for yourself and not run into challenges. And they're varied. They're, you know, are we going to make payroll this month or something like that? Those things in my past were pretty scary at certain points. And there are times when you don't take salaries because you want to pay your people. And you're worried about things in the technology and whether or not competitors are going to do things. We had a lot of competitors at AVV. We've had some really big competitors at AutoSuite in the physical inventory space. So you're always worried about that kind of stuff and you're thinking, is it going to hit me or not? And all you can really do is keep your nose to the grindstone and keep moving forward with what you think is right, or at least that's the way I function as a small business. I think the biggest failures or stuff that I look back on is when I try to take really big chances of inventing something new. It's really scary because you spend 6, 9, 12 months wondering if this is going to have traction. Like I seem to remember probably back in the late 90s or early 2000s, we tried to build a competitor to AutoTrader. We just didn't have the marketing or the financial, you know, backing to make something like that work, putting that portal site together and figuring that out. So we spent a lot of time building it, but then we couldn't execute on it. Fortunately, we had a lot of other business that was keeping us going. And so I try to take chances on little things like that and try to build it out and see if it gets some traction. And some things, they fizzle, they go away and you just let them die on the vine. And other things, you find that traction, you keep looking. It's almost like going back to the original thing where I said, we kept trying a bunch of different products until we found one that had traction and you just let that explode.
And what about the personal motivations? Like, has it been to build a lasting impact in a bunch of companies that their brand stays around forever? Has it been a monetary motivation? Like what's driven you over the years?
Well, the initial driver to become an entrepreneur was maybe that I thought I could do things better. It was also just a self-reliance that I knew I could do it because there's some risk in stepping out and trying something and taking a chance. And I know that I think I have rarely looked at myself and said, I can't do something, even when realistically I probably couldn't. So I think you have to have some sort of mentality that you can make things happen and you're not really too afraid if they fail. I remember when I first started, I remember thinking, you know, if this doesn't work out, I can wait tables and make enough money to make my house payment. You know, there's always a fallback for me that I'll survive. And even today, you know, I certainly have more money than that today. But even if I failed tomorrow, I know that I can still survive and that the things that are really important to me are still going to be there. My family, my friends, my hobbies and my activities. You know, maybe I can't live in a big house or something like that, but I just always think that I can do it. And if I can't, I'm going to be fine because the world's been pretty good to me, I guess. I'm fortunate.
And what about the goals for the future?
Well, I think that with AutoSuite, I'm super excited about where we are and how we've built a bunch of technology. We've got a lot of very specific plans about what we want to do. But just the general rule is that we just want to keep growing. I've got 45 employees now with AutoSuite, and it's not a huge company. It's not a small company. It's not me and two other people or something like that, like it was 25 years ago. But I have a real concern about that group of people who the reality is they've built this. It's not just me. It's not like I had some brilliant idea and put it together and made this huge thing happen. We've all been working together. I mean, I just announced yesterday at a meeting, three or four people, one had been with me for 17 years, another one for 12. These people are all really important to the company and important to me. And I think that in valuing them, we want to build something together. That's really, I think, what a lot of people are in it with AutoSuite. I think we're really in it to kind of feel that same ownership and that feeling that you've done something that's kind of lasting. It may not be hugely important, but it gives me something to wake up to, feel good about. I've built something and we're building it together as a team. In fact, we follow a management practice, which is pretty popular, I think, these days. We've been doing it now for about 12 or 15 years, maybe. It's called EOS, it's the Entrepreneurial Operating System. And they ask us, as many companies do, to do something called a purpose, cause, passion, what drives you to work, or what's your mission? I think a lot of companies do. And we had a mission statement like, you know, we want to be the best marketing company in the country for automotive dealerships or something like that. And we started thinking about that and saying, this just doesn't really work for us. What is our purpose? What's our cause? Why are we here? Why do we show up to work every day? And our purpose at AutoSuite is that we're here to do stuff we enjoy with technology. We're all nerds. And we like it. And we want to do something with technology. We want to build a world that's better for us personally, professionally, and we want to enjoy the people that we're working with. That's really why we're working. It's to be a part of this community, to build something, to do things that we have that we think are fun, and to make our lives better year over year. And that, to me, is why we wake up and go to work. And so we're going to keep doing that. And for my future, I'm going to keep trying to do that for the employees, and I'll do it as long as I can. And then hopefully I can start to slowly taper off and not work as I get older.
And yeah, someone like you, I feel like it's going to be hard to, or the desire to ever stop is probably not there, but maybe spend more time away, I would assume.
Well, I have other passions that I'd like to pursue. I've done some things in the past. Like, I like inventing little things. I made a food product called a Megan that was really fun and exciting for me to experiment and try to figure out how to do something in the food product world. That kind of stuff's interesting to me, but really passion for me is my sailing. And I really want to do more of it. I really want to take on some long-term adventures. I have a bucket list item. I want to circumnavigate the Atlantic, and I want to do that maybe solo, terrify my wife again. But I really do want to do it, and I'm excited about it, and I'm doing things to prepare for it. I do some things. I'm a part of an organization called the Great Lakes Solo Sailors. It's a group of people on the Great Lakes that have sailing challenges and competitions, and I have competed in three of them now, but they have one on each of the Great Lakes. And so I also have a bucket list item of sailing on each of the Great Lakes and competing in this and actually doing a trip where you actually race. Usually it's about between 15 and 25 people in each race. And we all solo sail from one point to the other. Like, for example, started in Monroe, Michigan, sailed up over Pelee all the way to Buffalo and then back to Erie, Pennsylvania for one race. And that was fun. I was real excited about that. It challenges you. It makes you learn new technology. It makes you prepare for risk and make sure that you understand safety. And I really enjoy that kind of stuff. And I'd like to do more of that. So I'd like to find more time to take some of those long-term trips because circumnavigating the Atlantic Ocean is not something you do and still have a job.
Yeah, it's not a short one. There's not a lot of Wi-Fi out there, I don't think.
Well, today, thanks to Elon Musk, there is.
Yeah, there might be.
But it's really expensive.
What about our last question? The show is centered around our theme, which is live uncomfortably. And as you think back on your life and career, I wonder if it applies to it, what it means to you, what you think about when you hear that.
Well, I think that you should always challenge yourself and not just in risks about, you know, starting a new company or something like that. That's certainly a risk to take. But about little things like, you know, learning to solo sail the Great Lakes, that's a challenge. I'm pushing myself and you learn stuff from that. You learn how to learn from other people. You learn how to challenge your body, you know, in ways that you didn't challenge yourself before. And the same thing is true in all kinds of different things. I mean, interpersonal relationships. Sometimes you got to learn new things about people or listen or challenge the way you do things. And it's uncomfortable to do that kind of stuff. But that's how people grow. That's how you become a better human being. It just across the board, and it pays dividends when you listen to the world around you and you say, I'm doing something wrong, or I can do something better, and you try to figure out how to do it. There's all kinds of very small ways that can happen. And it's not just starting a new company. It's, you know, finding more time to do things with your kids, or being a basketball coach and you've never played basketball in your life, but you're helping your kids. I mean, things like that, that you can do just to step out, you know, being a person in the community that says, I'm going to help other people and I'm going to do something like Habitat for Humanity, or I'm going to go down and feed people or something like that. But taking chances to get in front of people that make you nervous, I think it's good. I think you'll grow from it. And I know that I have challenged myself to do it over and over again. I mean, joining the army, that was terrifying. being prepared to maybe go overseas for war, that's scary, but you prepare yourself for it. You just got to keep looking for those opportunities and saying, how can I be better? And I think it will absolutely pay dividends.
Well, that's a great answer. Thank you so much for joining us. Cool to hear about your story and excited to see what you continue to accomplish going forward. And once you circumnavigate, is that what it is? Circumnavigate? Is that how you pronounce it?
Circumnavigate the Atlantic.
Circumnavigate the Atlantic. Nice.
Well, yeah. Well, this summer, I'm just going to sail from Port Huron to Mackinac. That's the challenge this summer.
Yeah. Baby steps, though.
Baby steps, right? See how I can do it and then move on to the bigger ones later.
Thanks again for jumping on.